Well, Brian has pointed out to us already, but this morning we come to one of the most famous passages in all the Bible. And even if you're not a Christian or you're not very familiar with the Bible, you know the names of the people in this story. Who are their names? David and Goliath. If you've watched movies, you've heard this story. Hoosiers, that award-winning film by Gene Hackman, a ragtag basketball team from a farm town in Indiana. They're going to play, who is it? South Bend? Somebody they're going to play. Some big team. And in the locker room, they read the story of David and Goliath. And they go out and they win. Now, I'm embarrassed to tell you this. Not so embarrassed that I won't tell you this. On my junior high, I was a junior higher brought up to the varsity team to fill the bench so they could have 10 players. It was a Christian school in Virginia. We were going to play a giant of a team. And an upperclassman quieted the locker room and he pulled out his pocket Bible and he read the story of David and Goliath so that we could have courage in this basketball game. And we left the locker room in a huff and we lost. But the point is the same. God helps us overcome our giants. Or maybe you've heard David and Goliath in some literature that you've read. Author Malcolm Gladwell, New York, Atlantic, some magazine. He's written Outlier and What the Dog Saw, and he often presents stories, true stories based on social psychology and social science research that often ends with a kind of unexpected twist, like some kind of O. Henry story at the end that surprises you. Well, in 2013, he wrote a book. Here's the title, David and Goliath, Underdogs, Misfits, and the Art of Battling Giants. Some interesting chapters in the book, even on pursuing justice and the necessity of practicing forgiveness while you pursue justice. But Gladwell opens the book with, you guessed it, an interesting historical account of the Battle of David and Goliath. Now, if you've read it, or if you're going to read it, it's not long, but Gladwell doesn't get the point of David and Goliath at all. So don't be fooled if you go out and read it or you have read it. But if you're here and you're someone who doubts the Bible, you should think of why an intellectual like Malcolm Gladwell treats the Bible as historically accurate and then interacts with it. Think about that. Well, similar to Hoosier's film, but in a much nonfiction, well-researched way, Gladwell shows how underdogs who exercise faith, like David, can overcome giants in the modern world. And then there's the movie. The movie that you're all thinking, maybe. Facing the Giants. That great cinematic film of literary art, a masterpiece. Well, of course it's not perfect by any stretch. But it's certainly far less deadening to your soul than other things that you could watch. The film ends. The football team plays a team called, you guessed it, the Giants. It all comes down to the field goal kicker, because every football game seems to come down to the field goal kicker. The coach gives a rousing speech. The field goal kicker looks up and he sees his dad, who's been in a wheelchair the whole movie, but inspired by the moment, his dad, who's been in a wheelchair, stands up, puts his hands like this. His son sees him, God, please help me. And he kicks the winning field goal and they face the Giants and they won. And the coach says, nothing is impossible if you put God first in your life. So face your giants, whatever they are. So from Hoosiers to Malcolm Gladwell to Facing the Giants, all of vastly different literary and cinematic quality, the message is similar. Through faith, underdogs can overcome any giant they're facing. That's a popular way to understand the story of David. Put your faith in God, and you can overcome the giants of anxiety, or the giant of starting a new business. Or if you're a student, the giant of algebra you can overcome by putting your faith in God. Somebody's clapping. Was that a big one for people? I'm still waiting for that giant to be overcome in my life. Now, without intending to, that's a common way to understand the passage. But I think that many of us recognize that's a giant way to misunderstand what's going on in this passage. It reads the story in such a way, without intending to, well-intended, that we too overcome the giants in our lives. It makes the story about us. And it puts us as the hero, and not just this story, but in every story in the Bible, as if God was kind of some Tony Robbins coach to help you be you much better. But this passage is all about God and the champion that He provides. In fact, the entire Bible, friends, celebrates what Christ has done through His Son by the power of His Spirit, something you and I could never do. That's what the whole Bible's about. But I also want to be careful this morning. Some think that David's faith has nothing to teach us at all. But I don't think that's accurate either. Why? Well, Hebrews 11, which we read together this morning, actually presents David as an encouragement to faith, and the biblical author wants us to see David as an encouragement of faith at some of them. So listen, David does far more than provide us an example. And his faith is not even the most important thing to know about David. But at some level, David's trust in the Lord is meant to encourage our trust in the Lord. Because David and Samuel, through faith, conquered kingdoms, were made strong out of weakness, and became mighty in war. So if God used an unknown, weak shepherd boy named David who trusted in Him, then God can use anyone who trusts in this God. That's what you learn at some level from David's life too. Learn from David what we just sung. Learn from David that God is so big. Learn that God is so mighty. Learn that there's nothing God cannot do. With you, for you. Learn the lesson from David's faith. And yet, of course, again, while there are things to learn from David, we dare not neglect what's most important. And what is that? David, by his office as a king and his actions as a king, is pointing us to God's ultimate champion. That's what we'll see today. That's our title. God provides the champion. So if you get lost this morning, or if you wonder what in the world are we talking about, or what should I write over 1 Samuel 17, write this, think this, God provides a champion. That's where we're going this morning. And who that champion is, that will make all the difference in your life. God provides a champion. Well, if you haven't already, I've mentioned the text. Would you locate 1 Samuel 17? It's in the first half of the Christian Bible, 1 Samuel 17. It's one of the longest chapters in Samuel, one of the most detailed chapters in Samuel. And because it's long and detailed, that means this chapter is really important. Let's begin by reading 1 Samuel 17, 1 to 10. Becky asked me last night, am I only going to read this whole chapter? And I said to her, there are lots of sins that churches commit, but reading the Bible too much is not one of them in modern services. So we will work our way through this text, section at a section, in the form of a story. So 1 Samuel 17, 1 to 10, two armies are gathering for battle, and let's watch the battle gather. Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle. They were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Soko and Azekah and Ephes Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion, named Goliath of Gath. His height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of a spear was like a weaver's beam, and the spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer went before him. he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." This is God's word. Well, we've walked right onto a battlefield. And we see a desperate situation and an aggressive accuser. A desperate situation and an aggressive accuser. One writer points out how eerily beautiful and historically significant this place of battle actually is. It's an area of breathtaking beauty, home to vineyards and wheat fields and sycamore trees. And over the centuries, numerous battles for strategic locations, regions have been fought. Saladin faced off against the king of the Crusades here, Knights of the Crusades in the 12th century. 1,000 years earlier, the Maccabean Wars with Syria took place here. And now, in this historic and bucolic, beautiful valley, the fledgling kingdom of Israel is squaring off with the Philistines. The Philistines, who are fierce fighters, arch enemies of Israel. Each army stations itself on opposite ridgelines, and both armies lie still, fidgeting in anxious silence. Neither one wants to draw first blood and make the first move. It's a desperate situation. To attack, writes Malcolm Gladwell, meant descending down the hill and making a suicidal climb up the enemy's ridge on the other side. Finally, the Philistines have enough. They send their greatest warrior down into the valley to resolve the deadlock. And now before Israel and King Saul stands an aggressive accuser. And do you see how Goliath looked? The details read like a scene from a James Fenimore Cooper, Charles Dickens novel. The details highly unusual for Hebrew narrative. It's like the weigh-in before a fight. Goliath of Gath stands in various measurements, 9 feet tall. Taller than Saul, who was originally chosen because he was so tall. His intimidating size is matched by the most advanced military weaponry and protection. He has a bronze helmet and a 125-pound coat of armor on him. And there will be no, Karate Kid, there will be no sweeping the leg. He has bronze shin guards from his knee down to his shin. A javelin of bronze is slung between his shoulders, and his muscular fingers are wrapped around a spear, the tip of which weighs 15 pounds of iron. And not only that, but he has a shield bearer going before him. Here stands a brazen giant, a picture of terror. Robert Alter, he's an expert in Jewish narrative, he describes the scene like this. Goliath moves into the action as a man of iron and bronze, an almost grotesquely quantitative embodiment of a hero, a hulking monument to an obtusely mechanical conception of what constitutes power. Now, friends, this is the first detail in the story that this story isn't telling you how you can overcome your giants. Goliath's description is meant to tell you, you cannot face this giant. You are in an impossible situation. You can't overcome this situation, you know, with a swig of Red Bull verses from the Bible to give you a boost to get past this guy. This is impossible. It's hopeless. This is a giant you cannot face. And then it gets worse. I love his name at the beginning of the chapter, Goliath of Gath, speaks. And did you hear what he said? Twice he challenges the military manhood of Israel. Give me a man to fight me. Choose a man who will come and fight me. And the rest of the story hangs on Goliath's question. Now the action starts to rise. Here's the question. Who is a man who will fight Goliath? The rest of the chapter is occupied with a search for a man who will face Goliath. And Goliath invokes an ancient way of warfare. He actually says, this ancient way of warfare is going to provide a clear victor, and it's designed to reduce the number of casualties on both sides. You give me your champion. If he wins, you win. If I win, we win. The stakes cannot be higher. Two principles are involved in this ancient warfare method. One is substitution. One man from each side to substitute for the entire nation and fight. Substitution. The next one is imputation. Whatever happens to that one man happens to the whole nation. If he wins, the whole nation wins. If he loses, the whole nation loses. Let's fight a battle man to man based on substitution and imputation. One man in for the whole nation. Stakes are pretty high. And that's a key to understanding the entire account. So Goliath, the aggressor, lays down a challenge and he ends with a snarl, I defy Israel. Four times in the chapter, that word will come up again. God's enemy is mocking God's people. And what will God do to someone who mocks his people? Where's the man? Where's the right man on our side? Well, maybe it will be King Saul. Remember, if you've been part of the story in 1 Samuel, the people chose Saul for this very reason. We want a king. We reject you, God. And we want a king, Saul, so that he will fight our battles for us. Maybe it's time for King Saul to step up. What does King Saul do? Look at verse 11. When Saul and all Israel heard the words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. The one they chose to save them is as afraid as they are. Saul, who hid in the baggage at his coronation, is now hiding in his tent on the battlefield when his people need him. And if King Saul won't fight, who will? Where is the man who will fight? And now the rest of the story is a desperate search for a champion to fight Goliath. So now we move from a desperate situation and an aggressive accuser to a desperate search for a worthy opponent. A desperate search for a worthy opponent. And this search goes all the way down to end of verse 37. Well, let's follow the nationwide search. The story now breaks away from the battlefield, and now it's going to focus on one family and an elderly dad and four of his boys. Verses 12 to 16, let's look at the search. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had eight sons. In the days of Saul, the man Jesse was already old and advanced in years. The three oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle. And the names of his three sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, and next to him, Abinadab, and the third, Shema. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward and took a stand morning and evening. This is God's word. Now, this is a really strange place to look for a man to face Goliath. An elderly father named Jesse and an out-of-the-way place named Bethlehem? But this is not the first time we've seen these people in place, is it? For the second time in two chapters, the author is introducing us to Jesse and four of his sons. The three oldest sons are on the front line, listening to Goliath mock God. And did you notice that according to verse 16, this is a battle, a challenge that goes on for 40 days. Every morning and every night, for 40 days, Jesse's three oldest sons hear Goliath come out and mock God twice a day for 40 days. For 40 days, the waters of Noah covered the earth. For 40 days, Israel wandered in the wilderness. And for 40 days, twice a day, Goliath cocked like a proud rooster at God's people. As a brief aside, do you know of any other time in the Bible when something significant happened in 40 days? Well, for 40 days, Eliab, whom Samuel thought was the next king, and Aminadab and Shammah are afraid. So what about the other son of Jesse? Doesn't he have a young son, David? Didn't we anoint him king in the last chapter? Maybe David, the unlikely king of 1 Samuel 16, can fight. But the narrator tells us that David is too young to fight. How do we know that? Well, in verse 14, it tells us that David is the youngest, a fact that appears like 6 or 7 times in this chapter about David. And what that means is that David is too young legally to fight. In our country, you know, you join at 18, the military. Well, in Israel, it's like 20 or 21. So the story's telling us that David is under 20 years old at this point. He can enlist and fight in the battle. Think about that. If you are 20 years old or younger, you have David's life experience and emotional mindset. 20 years or under, this is how old David is. Still a teenager in his upper years. And even though David then is the anointed king in 1 Samuel 16, he's too young to qualify to fight. And all David is still good for at this point is feeding the sheep. Now, as a quick aside, can you think of any other anointed king in the Bible from Bethlehem, who also was a shepherd? Well, David can't be the man. He's too young to fight, so the desperate search continues. Now, what the writer does now is he puts a GoPro camera on David, and now we're going to search for the next man through the eyes of David with David. So now we're going to follow David, and through the eyes of David, we're going to conduct the rest of the search. So let's follow the search. We go now from this household back to the battlefield searching for a man to fight Goliath. Verses 17 to 21. And Jesse said to David, his son, take for your brothers an ephah, this parched grain and these 10 loaves, and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. And also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well. Bring some token from them. Now Saul and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with the keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. Pause for a moment. Do you find it interesting? I find it interesting that David, who was anointed king in 1 Samuel 16, is obeying his father in 1 Samuel 17. What king do you know is supposed to obey anyone? David's obedience to his father puts him in a place of usefulness. Well, there's an application for kids, for young adults. Never underestimate the power of obeying. Do something radical, Haddon, that your classmates, Hank, Charlie, Catherine, Kennedy, that your classmates will never do or won't like to do. Obey your mom and your dad. Do something radical and watch God use you in important ways as you obey in ordinary ways. Now, as a quick aside, can you think of another anointed king in the Bible who obeyed his father? Well, in the course of obedience, David hears something for the first time. It's first sight of action, army against army, and then he hears something and it shakes him. What does he hear? Let's listen to verses 22 to 30. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. And he talked with them. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. I defy the ranks of Israel. Give me a man to fight me. The same words as before. And David heard him. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who's come up? Surely he's come up to defy Israel. And the king has offered a reward. He will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David said to the men who stood by him, you see, he's searching for a man. What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in the same way. So shall it be done for the man who kills him, a rich reward. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the other men in the army. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David and said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle. And David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? Can I even ask a question? And he turned away from his brother toward another one in the army, and he spoke the same way. He asked the same question, and the people answered him again as before. Well, Goliath's words deeply disturbed David, and he wants to know, can I modernize it? He wants to know who's going to take up this clown's challenge. And David is saying, you're looking at the wrong person. I see an uncircumcised Philistine against the armies of the living God. Who will stand up against? It won't be a fair fight. Who will stand up against him? And at this point, this young shepherd boy from Bethlehem shows more faith than his brothers, more faith than his father, and more faith than the king of Israel himself, Saul. From David's perspective, you remember last week? Man's extremity is God's opportunity. This isn't a match, David reasons. This uncircumcised Philistine against the armies of the living God? Why are you scared? David insulted the glory of God. That's another key in telling this story that's not about us and battling giants of big businesses and weaknesses at work. Goliath is attacking the glory of God, which means this, that any direct application you mean to this text has to come from a situation in which God's glory is being attacked and demeaned. That's the context. Goliath versus God, David sees. And David's shocked that the people are afraid because he's been humming, my God is so big, so strong and so mighty. There's nothing my God cannot do. You're looking at the wrong person. Now step back for a moment. What are the situations like that for us today? We are Israel in the story. We are Saul in the story. And we are afraid because God's glory is being attacked. Where do you see God's glory being attacked? In the world, in the culture, in your life. I mean, we could pick ones out here, Goliaths of culture and sexuality, and maybe Goliaths in your work culture that mock any hint for applying God's word. Goliaths, we've been praying for two from our church in a hostile situation. Goliaths and warlords of places hostile to God's name. And then what about your own sin? What about the Goliath, the giant nature of yours. Isn't every sin an assault against the glory of God? How will you fight your sin? Well, David is asking anyone who will listen. And his own brother, whom Samuel thought was going to be the king, despises him. The one who accused David of having an evil heart just showed his own heart, and God knew that in chapter 16. The most painful blows can come from those that are supposed to love us, even fellow Christians. David would later lament, "My own familiar friend." Can you think of another time when an anointed king was despised by his brothers and family? Well, David turns away from his brother. The search goes on again. I mean, will anybody listen? Will anybody hear me? So the desperate search continues. I think of everywhere we've been. We've looked in the royal palace, the king, Saul won't step up. We've searched the battlefield now twice and over 40 days. David is too young. It's like calling the names of my kids. I'll get to him eventually. So David is too young. Eliab is not the king. So where is the man who will fight for the people as a substitute? Where is the man whose actions can be imputed to the nation? Well, David's pesky prodding, his nosy reporter nature, catches the ear of somebody. And the search now goes from the battlefield to the king's tent on the battlefield. Let's read verses 31 to 37. Go into the king's tent. And our search for a champion is about to come to an end. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." And Saul said to David, "You're not able to go up against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he's been a man of war from his youth." David said to Saul, "Your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And once there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock. And I went after him, struck him, and delivered that lamb out of the bear's mouth. And if the lion arose against me, I caught him by his beard, and I struck him, and I killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears. And this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God." And David said, "The Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion," or literally, "the Lord who delivered me from the hand of the lion and the hand of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said to David, "Go, the Lord be with you." There's something very sad and very unexpected by the whole scene. What's the sad part? Saul has one final step, chance to step up. He's now heard nobody's volunteering, and he doesn't step up. Kings, by virtue of their own office, represent the people. He's got one small chance. He's supposed to be rebuked by a young boy coming to him. And Saul won't step up. And did you notice how verse 37 ends? It's a bit humorous, but I think it's sad. The Lord be with you. What about the Lord be with us? What about the Lord be with me? Saul, where has your relationship gone that you can no longer say the Lord be with me? Saul has fallen a long way as a king, but the furthest he's fallen is away from God. It's sad. But then it's unexpected. I mean, you probably saw it coming if you read this story for the first time. But who's finally chosen to fight? The one whom everybody says shouldn't fight. It's David. And the narrator's gone out of his way to tell you David is not the person to fight the Philistine. He's from Bethlehem. He works with the sheep. That's the modern equivalent. I'm from Bethlehem and work with the sheep. That's a modern equivalent as I'm from Pickens and I watch puppies and I want to go fight him. This is not the guy. His family despises him. And once more, David is too young. He's too inexperienced. Everyone knows David is not the one who should fight. It's a desperate situation, an impossible situation, against an aggressive accuser. Everybody's afraid. The king's afraid. God's people need someone to deliver him. And now the unexpected turn comes. The only man willing to fight is a man who's not old enough to fight. Is this all God has left? A guy in his upper teen years who's never been in the MMA ring in his life and he's going up against Goliath? Is this what God has to work with? Oh, friends, this is what God loves to work with. It's all he works with. David knows he's not up to the task, but he knows that God is up to the task. And he tells us that. He reflects on his job as a shepherd, and he reasons. This is his theological motivation. Because this uncircumcised Philistine defied the Lord. You see, I'm just going to keep hammering it to keep us from this. This isn't about starting a business or delivering a good presentation at work to the giants of the corporate world or kicking game-winning field goals. This is because somebody has defied and demeaned God's glory. And David says, listen, Saul, if God delivered me from the hand of the bear and the lion when his glory was not on the line, then I'll guarantee you God will deliver me when his glory is on the line. Let me go and fight him. And David says, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your eyes are on the wrong giant. I see the Lord of armies who's alive. God now provides a despised champion, an overlooked champion, to fight a defiant champion. And now it's time to get dressed in the locker room. Now it's time for him to put on his boxing gloves. And Saul says, let me give you my armor. And the description sounds like Saul, Goliath getting ready. Look at Saul clothing David, verses 38 to 40. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. It starts where Goliath did. He put a helmet of bronze on his head. He clothed him with a coat of mail. And David strapped Saul's sword over his armor. And he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these. I've not tested them. So David put them off. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in a shepherd's pouch. Here is another indication that God doesn't win battles through weapons of the flesh. Isn't that often how we fight, though? Listen, we use everything but the means of grace, or we use them too sparingly, or we even rationalize that maybe I need a break from God's people or from the means of grace. Well, David's not going into battle with earthly weapons, with the king's armor. He's not going to dress like Goliath to fight Goliath. All he carries is a sling and 5 stones and a shepherd's pouch. Why 5 stones? I don't know. And you don't know. But here's my guess. David's preparing for battle. He's ready to fight to the death, however long it takes. He's ready to enter a 12-round fight. He's ready to enter a world war. He doesn't know how many stones it will take. But he's prepared to fight a bloody battle to the bloody death. 5 stones. This could be a long fight. That's instructive. We are called to endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ, to fight the fight of faith. So come what may, this isn't some bravado, but in the power of the Spirit, take heart, brothers and sisters, and for the glory of God, in the Spirit of God, settle in, fight, and endure hardship for the captain of your salvation. And now comes the moment we've been waiting for. The valley grows quiet, like a meadow before a thunderstorm. The natural acoustics of the valley amplify the noise of every step, the jangling of every part of the Philistines' armor. An intense silence, they stop, they meet, and they stare. It's that stare down in the middle of the ring. And Goliath's insulted. He can't believe who he's facing. Listen to what he says, verses 41 to 45. Or 42 first. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with a shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him. For he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome. And he's not even been cut shaving yet. See how clean his face is? Goliath is right. He's not lying. For the third time in the story, David's youth and inexperience are pointed out. He's insulted. Robert Alter describes it like this. An egregiously red-headed pretty boy is sent to do battle with the mightiest Philistine warrior. And insulted, he belts out, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his "Come to me. I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. You can smell Goliath's foul breath." And David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know there's a God in Israel. That all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." Now we're at the heart of the story. This is the theological center of Hollywood would focus on the battle and what's to come. This is where you should focus. This is the heart of the story. This is not a battle between David and a Philistine. This is a battle between the false gods of the Philistines and the true God of Israel. The Philistine cursed David by his gods. And I don't know if David knew Hannah's song at this point from 1 Samuel 2, or he knew the tune, or if there was one, but David's word mirrors Hannah's song. She sang, "God will guard the heart of his faithful, and not by might where a man prevail." And David says, "I know that song. I know that song. And I know how God always works. And I've not come to you with weapons of earthly power. I've come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, without sword and without spear." And when the Philistine... You know that scene in The Christmas Story, another great film, and they're out on the playground and one of the kids goes right to the triple daub, double dare you, and violates all the protocol, goes right to it. If you don't know it, sorry. The point is that when Goliath curses David by his gods, he just drew a bullseye on his forehead. You just gave the finger to God and said, "Try me." And David heard it and saw it. That's why he's upset. You defied the glory of God. and God is zealous for His glory. And nobody gets away with demeaning the glory of God. And then comes the reminder, God is going to do this to teach two groups of people two really important lessons. God's going to bring you down so that the whole world would know there's only one God. And so that all of Israel will know God saves without spear or sword. The battle is the Lord's. This story is in the Bible so that people who don't know Jesus would know there's only one God, and so that we as Emmanuel Bible Church would be reminded the battle is the Lord's. That's why it's here. And now, the moment we want is about to happen. But remember, this is the indication that God wants to go, can I put it like this? Global with His glory. He raised up Pharaoh that everyone would know my glory, and I raised up God. I made him really tall so that people would debate how really tall he is. Even today, he's this tall, he's this. Yeah, I made him tall. You know why I made him tall? So that my glory would go global. And so that people at Emmanuel Bible Church would know the battle always belongs to me. You see the glaring problem about making this a story about underdogs? This is not about underdogs. It's about God. It's His battle. It's about how God fights. And the glaring problem, listen, the glaring problem with whoever wrote it, well-meaning, the song like Only a Boy Named David and Only a Little Sling, God's not mentioned in the song anywhere at all. If David heard it, he would cringe. Did you hear what I said the story's about? How can you write a song that doesn't say anything about God's glory going global and His people knowing how God fights? It's not only a boy named David. It's only a God named Jehovah. And now we're ready. Now we're ready. The bell rings. Ding, ding. Verses 48 to 51. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag. He took out a stone. He slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone and struck the Philistine and killed him. And did you see that? There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran, stood over the Philistine, took out his sword, drew it out of its sheath, killed him, and cut off his head with it. It's over in a flurry of verbs. David rushes, he takes, he hurls, he hits, and the giant falls face down to the ground, and dust around his face goes. I don't know if it did, but it should have. And everybody gets quiet. And here's the great irony. What is the penalty in Israel for blaspheming God? Death by stoning. And this blasphemer got a stone to his head, and it sunk into his head, and he falls face down. Do you know of anyone else in this story, a Philistine towering figure who fell face down before God? It was the Philistine stone statue, Dagon. Goliath has been as helpless as Dagon the whole time. Down he falls. It's not down goes Frazier, it's down goes Goliath. And verse 50 wants you to be real clear about this. God did it without a sword, without human might. And then David the teenager runs and he stands over and he unsheaths and he severs. And God's despised king crushes the giant's head with a stone and then he decapitates the giant's head with his own sword. Why decapitation? That's to be a shocking proof to us today, as it was to them then, that the Philistine is really dead. There it is. A battle of 40 days is over in a flash. Then in a brief, pregnant silence, the Philistine's head shifts into the dust, maybe in slow motion, and two things happen at once. The tables are turned instantly. Now, the Philistines saw their champion was dead and they fled, we read. Their substitute had lost his head, and now his death would be their death. His death is imputed to them, so now they run in terror. That's not the only thing that happened. Israel's substitute, God's champion, won. His victory is now imputed to his people. And when the people see the victory of God's anointed king, what do they do? 52 to 54. And the men of Israel and Judah arose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath at the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'arim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem. And he put his armor in his tent. You see, God's victory, God's champion, does a number of things for the people. First, it frees them from fear and bondage of the Philistines. Second, it transforms them. They're no longer afraid. It frees them from fear and bondage. It transforms them. They're no longer afraid, and enables them and emboldens them now to fight. And it guarantees their advancing won't be in vain. Frees, transforms, enables, emboldens, and guarantees that their fight now won't be in vain. David's victory has been imputed to them. And then the chapter ends in an anticlimactic way. But I think it underlines the point of the story of final time. Let's read the end of the story, verse 55. And as soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." As soon as David returned from striking down the Philistine, Abner took him, can you imagine the scene, and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. Saul said to him, "Who are you?" And David answered, "I'm the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." This is the word of the Lord. What's the point of the curious end? It underlines God's champion was a nobody, a youth, for an obscure town in Bethlehem. This is the day God provide a despised, unknown champion to defeat a notorious, defiant champion. And so we sing with Hannah, "My heart exults in the Lord. My mouth derides my enemies, because I have seen your salvation." Now, what do we make of all? Well, here's the theme. God provides a champion to deliver his people from an impossible situation. God provides a champion to deliver his people from an impossible situation. And then you have to put this story in the story of the Bible. David is God's anointed king who fulfills promises of Genesis 3 and Deuteronomy 17. David is called God's Messiah, God's King, His anointed one. We are familiar with promises and predictions, how they point to Christ. A virgin will conceive, a virgin conceived, right? We understand those things, but we don't always remember that people and their offices can point to Christ in the same way. Thus, when God gave David as a Messiah to his people, He was promising through David to give them a greater Messiah. And we're not making that up because the New Testament opens with Jesus is the son of David. That means you're to look at David, but then you're to look through David. And when you look through David, God's Messiah King, you see God's final Messiah King. That David's life, all of his actions, point to Jesus' life and Jesus' actions. Jesus is the champion that God provides. So now go back. So in the you read every passage in the Bible in its context. And every passage in the Bible is in the context of the entire Bible. So when you read 1 Samuel 17, you're getting a preview into how Jesus will deliver his people from their sin. 1 Samuel 17 is a preview of Jesus, the son of David, and how he defeats and conquers sin at the cross. Think about it. Do you know another unknown anointed king who came from Bethlehem? David was despised and overlooked, and so was Jesus. David is a shepherd. Jesus is the good shepherd. David obeys his father in the chapter. Jesus always does the things that please his father. Just as David's family despised him, Jesus' family despised him. But Jesus just isn't like David. Jesus is greater than David. David crushed Goliath and won with a sling. Jesus crushed Satan and won with a cross. David risked his life. Jesus gave his life. David's life was a substitute for the nation. Jesus' life was a substitute for all who would ever trust in him. David's victory was imputed to one nation. Jesus' victory, his resurrection, his victory was imputed to all who would ever trust in him. Don't you see? 1 Samuel 17 shows Jesus the champion that God provides. It's telling you, David through faith conquered kingdoms, but now look away to Jesus who's the champion and perfecter of our faith. Jesus was stripped and killed so that we could be clothed and filled. Jesus is despised and rejected so that we could be loved, so that we could be accepted. He's made weak in battle so that you could be strong in battle. He stood in for us so that we could go free. Jesus died that we might live. It's all about the God who provides Jesus Christ for an enemy worse than Goliath to give a victory greater than David's. And what's the point? This is a God who provides a champion for us. And this king can forgive any sin and use any sinner. This king can forgive any sinner, any sin, and use any sinner because the battle is the Lord's. And number two, the God who provides a champion will use anybody who follows that champion. Anybody. And what does it mean for you? Two things. It means you need to stop working to please God. Stop relying on Goliath's armor. Christianity is not a self-help club. You can't save yourself. You're not as strong as you think you are. He has taken out kindly, he's taken out people greater than you are, and he can bring you to the end of yourself. The most important lesson in 1 Samuel 17 is this. It's not to be like this king, but to trust the king that God's provided. Where's your trust? Where's your hope? There's nobody who loves you like this and will forgive you when you fail. Nobody. There's no king like this. And just as David's victory then transformed and freed and enabled and guaranteed Israel's obedience, Jesus' victory transforms and guarantees and mobilizes us. The God who provides a champion will use anyone who follows that champion. So place your faith in God's King. And don't be afraid, Emmanuel Bible Church. Advance with the gospel. Share it. Take it. Speak up for God. For God's provided a champion. So serve the Lord and fear Him with all your heart as you consider what great things He's done.